done it. I am over the first hurdle. I squeeze in beside Miranda, crushing my bulky jacket into the narrow gap, and she laughs. Liz, how many layers are you wearing? You look like the Michelin man. Topher gives a grin.
Don't knock it, Miranda. Liz might have the last laugh when we get to the top.
He nods at the window, and I realise he is right. As the lift climbs, you can literally feel the weather getting colder. The condensation on the inside of the bubble begins to bead and then freeze, spreading into beautiful frost flowers as the lift climbs and climbs past the midway station where the doors slide open invitingly, but no one moves. Then out again and up past the tree line and up, up into the clouds. I can feel the little bubble being buffeted by the wind, feel it swaying on its wire, and I have a sudden thrill of fear at what is awaiting us at the top. Oh God, am I really going to do this? Can I really go through with it? Suddenly I'm not sure if I can. My stomach is sick and clenching with nerves. I've never felt so scared in my life of what I'm about to do, but I have to go through with it. I have to. And then the doors are sliding back and we are stumbling out into a cold so profound that it strikes right through all my layers, even inside the relative shelter of the lift terminal. We clip on our skis and slide out into a white wilderness. It is snowing hard. The wind is fierce and vicious, driving the snow into our eyes and noses, making everyone fumble to pull down their goggles and pull up their scarves. Between that and the cloud that has descended to wreath the mountain, the visibility is not the miles the brochures promised, it is metres. I know that there should be two runs coming off here. To the left is the black run Topher wants to do, La Sorcière. To the right is the top part of the blue run, Blanche-Neige. They meet at the second station of the bubble lift, but Blanche-Neige takes its time, curving round the mountain in gentle loops. La Sorcière, on the other hand, follows a more direct route, zigzagging down the mountain beneath the bubble lift. Direct is an understatement. We passed over the run in the lift a few minutes ago and it looked like a sheer sheet of ice, like the side of a hill, even seen from 40 feet up in the air. I push off, wobbling as I clear the ice from my goggles with my mittens. Ahead is a snow-covered sign that might once have been two arrows but is now nothing but an indistinct white lump. To the left, there is a kind of tennis net thing cutting off the access. By the time I see this, I'm sliding towards it. Help! I shout. There is nothing any of the others can do, and I ricochet into the net, feeling its springiness catch me across the middle. I flail for a moment, my poles pinwheeling, and then I teeter ungracefully to the ground in a clatter of skis. Rick comes sliding across, laughing, and helps me up.
You were lucky,
he yells in my ear over the shriek of the wind, pointing to the snow-blasted Piste Fermée sign tacked over the net.
That's La Sorcière. You could have been skiing your first black if they hadn't closed the piste, or worse.
He is right. Beyond the net is a deep run dropping almost vertically away. It curves around the mountain and beyond the edge of the curve is nothing. If I had shot off the edge at speed, there would have been nothing anyone could do. I could have been plummeting to my death in the valley 1,000 feet below before anyone had a chance to stop me. The thought of that fall makes my stomach lurch with nerves at the thought of what I'm about to do. I am too out of breath to reply, but I let him haul me to my feet and then guide me back to the others who are standing in a little huddle at the top of the blue piste.
"They've closed La Saucière,"
Rick calls across to Topher, who nods bitterly.
"I saw fucking pussies."
Should we wait?
I hear Miranda shout. Her voice is barely audible beneath the howling of the storm.
It's fucking freezing.
I think we have to,
Rick says.
We can't go without Annie and Carl. They're not very experienced.
They've got the others to babysit them,
Topher grumbles, but Rick shakes his head.
What if they come up separately and try to follow? Look!
He points down the mountain where a bubble lift is emerging from the clouds. A single figure inside, or maybe two, sitting close together. It's impossible to make out at this distance. It might not even be one of our party. It is so far below that the figure looks absurdly small. I am shaking. My heart is pounding. I can't go through with this. But I have to. This might be my last chance. I have to say something. Now. Now.
I can't do this,
I force out. Topher looks across at me as if surprised I've spoken.
What did you say?
I can't do this,
I say louder. I am breathing very fast and my voice is high and squeaky with a barely contained fear. My pulse is going a mile a minute.
I can't. I just can't. I'm not going to ski down. I can't, Topher.
Well, how do you plan to get to the bottom?
Topher says sarcastically.
Toboggan? Hey, hey.
Rick has been trying to consult his phone, but now he looks up.
What's going on here?
I can't do it,
I say desperately, as if... if I just keep repeating this one phrase, everything will slot into place. Maybe it still will. Maybe it will all be okay.
I can't ski down in this. I'm going to die, I know I will. You can't make me do it.
Liz, it'll be fine.
Rick puts a hand on my arm.
I'll take care of you, I promise. Look, you can snowplow all the way down if you want to. I'll guide you. You can hold my sticks.
I can't do it,
I repeat doggedly. If I just keep repeating this, it will be okay. They can't make me ski with them. I know Topher, he's not a patient man. Very soon he will get pissed off with trying to persuade me and give up.
Fuck,
Topher says irritably. He wipes the snow from his goggles and looks at Rick.
So what then? Liz?
Rick begins, and I feel that hard thing rise up in my throat, choking me like it did at the meeting. The bubble with the single figure in it reaches the terminal. I think I'm going to be sick. It's now or never.
I can't do it!
I scream. And suddenly, out of nowhere, I am crying. The noise astonishes me, great, ugly sobs racking me. I lift up my goggles to scrub at my eyes with my frozen gloves, and the wind is so cold I can feel the tears running down my nose, freezing as they reach the tip. I swipe away the frozen drops, feeling them crackle against my skin.
I can't fucking do it.
Okay, okay,
Rick says hastily.
Liz, don't panic, it'll be fine. Look, we'll sort this out.
There is a shushing sound behind us, and we turn to see a figure skiing down the slope towards us. It is Inigo, his green jacket unmistakable even with his goggles down and his scarf pulled up. Behind him, Tiger has shuffled out onto the bank immediately outside the lift. She's sitting on the snow, fastening her snowboard bindings.
I'm going back,
I say, gulping down my sobs. I point down the mountain where the empty bubble lift Inigo came up in is returning back to the valley.
I'm going to talk to the lift attendant, make him let me back in. I'll explain I can't do it, that it's all been a mistake.
Liz, this is fucking ridiculous.
Topher explodes.
What's the matter?
Inigo's voice is muffled from behind his scarf, barely recognisable.
It's Liz,
Topher says angrily.
She's having some kind of existential crisis.
But I'm not. I'm calm now. I know what I have to do, and this is all going to be okay. There is another bubble lift coming up the mountain with another figure inside it. I can do this. I know what I need to do, and no one can stop me. I begin to sidestep up the slope.
Liz,
Rick calls.
Are you sure?
Yes,
I yell back, though I'm not even certain they can hear me over the wind now.
I'm quite sure. I'll meet you back at the chalet.
And as I step inside the terminal building and the bubble lift doors open, a sense of peace enfolds me. I know what I have to do, and it's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay.
Erin. Snoop ID Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 10.
It's nearly 1:30. They said they'd be back by 1 at the latest. And Danny is shouting expletives from the kitchen as the minutes tick past and his risotto clogs. At 1:45, he sticks his head out the door with a face like thunder and I shake my head.
There's only one thing I hate more than fucking stealth vegans, and that's wankers.
He growls and disappears, the swing door clacking behind him. And then suddenly there's the clatter of ski boots on tiles, and I hurry into the lobby to hear noises from the ski entrance, the unmistakable sounds of people clumping along a hard floor, clanging open the heated ski lockers that line the corridor.
Ava,
someone calls irritably.
Ava, where the fuck are you?
No answer. Then the insulated door to the lobby swings open and Topher comes in wearing ski gear and thick socks looking pissed off.
Oh, it's you,
he says shortly when he sees me.
Where the fuck is Ava?
Ava? A retort about his rudeness hovers on the tip of my tongue, but I swallow it back. Sorry, Topher, I have no idea. He stops halfway to the stairs.
You mean she's not here?
No, you're the first back. He stands there quite still, the expression on his face wavering between irritation and concern. Then he calls over his shoulder,
Miranda, she's not here.
You're kidding.
Miranda is the next one out of the door. Her face is bright pink with the painful flush that always follows extreme cold.
Huh. Well, I guess at least that means we didn't freeze our asses off for no reason. But what do you think could have happened?
Maybe the lift closed before she could get on and she skied back down into Saint-Antoine to get the funicular?
Topher says. But Carl has come out now and is shaking his head.
She got on before me, mate. She was on that lift, I'd swear to it.
And I saw her,
Annie says. They gather in the lobby, sweaty and confused, melting snow dripping from their jackets.
I told you, Carl and I were coming up in the lift and I saw her skiing down.
What's the matter?
Rick says, coming through in his turn, shaking the snow off his black salopettes. Miranda turns to him, and now her face is definitely worried.
Ava's not here.
She's not here?
Rick's expression is blank.
But that's not possible. There's nowhere else she could be.
They all begin talking at once, offering up different theories, many of them totally impossible based on the geography of the resort. Hold up, hold up, I say, and amazingly, they all fall silent. Somehow they want leadership, and I am the closest thing to it. Start from the beginning. When was the last time you were all together as a group?
At the bottom of the Rennes ski lift, Annie says promptly. We had a discussion about whether to break for lunch there or do one last run. Topher made the point that it was uphill from the ski lift to the chalet, so we had to do a run, and we agreed to go up to the top station and do either La Sorcière or Blanche-Neige, depending on ability.
I bite back my reply to this. La Sorcière is a bitch of a run. I've been skiing all my life, and there's no way I'd do it in this weather. Even Blanche-Neige with this visibility is no joke for inexperienced skiers. Not for the first time, it strikes me that Topher is kind of a jerk.
But when we got up there, Liz had some kind of breakdown,
Topher says bitterly.
Toph,
Rick says sharply, with a jerk of his head towards the ski door, and I look over Topher's shoulder to see Liz plodding wearily across from the boot room. She is covered in snow and looks utterly exhausted, even more so than the others.
When we got to the top, the weather was pretty extreme, and Liz decided to take the lift back down,
Miranda says smoothly. But looking at Topher's mutinous face, I can well imagine the discussion that decision must have entailed. Part of me is amazed at Liz's strength of mind that she didn't let herself be bullied into trying the run. But fear can make people amazingly resilient.
The rest of us waited up there for the others,
Topher says.
But Ava never came.
But she did, Annie puts in. We saw her, Carl and I, didn't we?
She nudges Carl, who nods.
Yeah, no doubt about it, mate. We saw her get on the bubble a few lifts ahead of us. A few?
Topher says.
How's that? There was no queue at all.
Carl reddens.
Well, look, there's no point in beating about the bush. I fluffed getting on the bubble, if you must know. Annie and I were supposed to be getting in after Ava, but I tripped over my bindings, fell over, and the lift doors closed, and Ava went up with my skis still stuck in the rack. It took me a few minutes to get myself sorted again, and then Annie and I caught the next lift after that.
Could she have got confused and got off at the first station?
Miranda says with a frown, but Annie shakes her head.
No, that's what I'm trying to tell you. I saw her when we were coming up in the bubble. It goes right over that black piste, the really steep one that Topher wanted to do.
La Sorcière, I put in, and Annie nods.
That's the one. And I saw a skier coming down it. She stopped for a second on the ridge and kind of raised her hand, waving at me, and I realised it was Ava.
How could you tell at that distance?
Rick says sceptically.
It could have been anyone.
I recognised her red jacket. It's, like, really distinctive. No one else here has one like it, and we were the only people on that lift.
I look around the circle, and she's right. Topher is in mustard and khaki. Rick and Carl are both in black. Miranda is in a kind of purple jumpsuit. Inigo has a green jacket and black salopettes. Tiger is wearing kind of shabby surfer chic that looks like an 80s denim bomber jacket and cargo pants, but I suspect is actually pretty expensive snowboard gear. Liz is wearing a faded navy blue all-in-one that's too big for her and looks as though it was borrowed from a friend. And Annie herself is wearing the bright sea blue jacket and white salopettes that I noticed earlier. None of them could possibly be mistaken for Ava.
When we got off at the top, my skis were waiting,
Carl says.
She must have taken them off the lift and then skied off.
Didn't you notice she wasn't at the top? I ask, and Rick shakes his head, looking rueful.
No, the visibility was really poor and, well, look, if you must know, there was a bit of, argy-bargy at the top.
Argy-bargy? What the hell does that mean? I'm about to ask when Miranda butts in.
You might as well say it plainly, Rick. The lift attendant came out to tell us the avalanche warning had gone up to red and they were closing the whole mountain. But half the party ignored the warning and deliberately skied off before they could get the nets out.
I'm so sorry.
Inigo at least has the grace to look embarrassed.
It was a total misunderstanding. I thought he was saying now or never, so I, pushed off.
So, wait, some of you skied home, I say slowly, and some of you took the bubble back down? Nods all round the circle.
Naturally, we stopped for a bit at the big pine by the shortcut back to the chalet to see if anyone was catching up, but when we saw people travelling back down in the bubble, we skied down to the bottom of the lift,
Topher says.
So we waited there for another 20 minutes, only for the bastards in charge of the resort to close that lift too. At that point, we concluded Ava had fucked off back to the chalet, but since we were now downhill from the chalet with no functioning lift, we had no choice but to ski down to Saint-Antoine and get the funicular back up.
Okay. Okay, I say slowly, trying to make sense of it. So, the last time anyone is absolutely certain they saw her, she was skiing La Saussure? Annie nods, turning to Carl for confirmation, who says,
that's the size of it.
But La Saussure was closed, Topher explodes. That was the whole fucking problem.
The whole fucking problem is that your colleague and co-founder is missing in extreme weather conditions. I think, but I don't say it. I'm thinking about La Saussure, about its treacherous icy slopes and the way the loose powder builds up on the sheet ice beneath, making every turn a throw of the dice between a painful skid and a mini avalanche. I'm thinking of its brutal moguls, hidden by the drifting snow between, and the impossibility of even seeing the icy hummocks beneath their blanket of snow, let alone judging those knee-juddering turns in bad visibility. Most of all, I'm thinking of the sheer drop at the side of the run. A precipice lies just metres from the side of the piste in places. In conditions like this, you could simply sail off the edge into nothingness. That is why they shut La Saussure first, out of all the runs in the resort. Not because they're risk-averse or health and safety nuts or don't trust experienced skiers to navigate it, but because the twists and turns are a death trap in low visibility. But then I remind myself that the worst section of the drop is right at the start of the run, and Annie saw her skiing further down. It's small comfort, but I'll take whatever comfort I can get right now. Has anyone tried her mobile? I say. Inigo nods.
Several times, there's no reception.
Danny comes out of the kitchen at that point, looking royally pissed off. What about my fucking risotto? He mouths at me over the heads of the guests and I hurry across to him. Ava's missing, I tell him in a low voice, and his expression switches instantly from irritation to concern.
What? Really missing? Not just gone AWOL?
I don't know, it's hard to tell. They've all acted like complete fuckwits. They split up. No one kept track of who was in which party, and Ava seems to have gone off by herself to ski La Saussure.
Alone?
Danny's jaw drops.
But there's a red avalanche warning. Why the hell didn't the pisteurs shut the run?
Apparently, they did. She must have ducked under the netting or something, or somehow got lost and traversed across to the wrong run. Though I can't think quite how that could have happened. There is no obvious interconnection between Blanche-Neige and La Saussure. That's part of the problem with the Black Run. It is hemmed in by a sheer cliff on one side and a sheer drop on the other. There is no way out once you're going down. It's all twists and turns. I don't know, but Annie is pretty convinced she and Carl saw Ava skiing down it. I mean, I know she's good, but that's just foolhardy in weather like this. Danny's face is really grave now.
And no one's seen her since.
I shake my head. Do you think we should call the PGHM? I ask. This is the specialist branch of mountain police who operate in the higher mountain ranges, a combination of gendarme and mountain rescue.
I dunno,
Danny says. He pushes his bandana up his forehead and rubs fretfully at the furrow between his brows, trying to think.
It's not impossible she's just got lost and gone down the wrong route. With the lift shut, it'd take her a while to get back. I reckon they'll tell us to give it a few hours before we panic. Should we try the ski pass office first? Maybe they can tell us if her pass has been used on any lifts.
I want to kiss him. It's not just a good idea, it's a great one. But when I go to the phone in the lobby and dial the number on the back of the lift pass, I get only the insistent beep-beep signal of a busy line. I go back to the little group huddled in the lobby who are looking hot in their ski gear and increasingly worried. We think the best thing is to check in with the lift pass office and see if Ava's used her pass anywhere. I've tried phoning, but the line's engaged, so rather than hanging around here, I think I'm going to hop down on the funicular and talk to the office in person.
I'll go,
Topher says immediately. Do you speak French? I know the answer before I ask the question, and his face changes to chagrin as he shakes his head. I totally get why you want help, I say, trying to be gentle, but I think it would be better for someone who speaks French to go. If she's not used her pass, that's probably the point where we need to report her missing to the police, and we'll definitely need a fluent speaker for that. You should all change into dry clothes and get some food into you, and I'll be back really soon. Meantime, keep trying her number. They all nod soberly.
I'd better tell Elliot, Topher mutters.
And I remember with a shock of surprise that Elliot was the only member of the group not skiing. He is still holed up in his room, presumably working on his coding update or whatever he's doing up there alone. They all disperse, talking quietly under their breath to each other, and I grab my coat from the locker and hurry back to Danny to explain the plan.
So you'll have to serve up alone, is that okay?
He nods.
Yeah, of course.
He disappears into the kitchen to begin plating up. I put my coat on and open the front door.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 0.
I am upstairs in my room, changing out of my skiing clothes when it happens. At first, it is just a noise. And then I feel the ground begin to shake like an earthquake. I turn to look out of the window. I see what looks like a wall of snow coming down the valley towards us. But not a wall, that implies something solid. This is something else. A boiling mass that is air and ice and earth all rolled together. I scream. I do the only thing I can, even though it is stupid. I fall to my knees with my arms over my head, as if that pathetic gesture might protect me. I stay there shaking for a long time before I dare to get up, my legs trembling. Did it miss us? Did it stop? From far away, I can hear other voices, shouts, screams, cries. Somehow, I force my legs to work and I stumble out into the corridor.
Jesus Christ!
Topher is shouting. He is running towards the stairs.
What the hell just happened?
Erin!
I hear from below. It is a bellow of fear from a voice I don't recognise, and then I realise it is the chef, Danny, calling for his friend.
Erin!
The corridor is full of terrified people. There is a smoke alarm going off, shouts of panic. Down in the lobby, the chef is struggling with the front door, which has cracked and bowed beneath the weight of packed snow pressed up against it.
Don't open the bloody door,
Topher yells.
You'll let all the snow in.
Danny turns on him. His face is full of fury.
My fucking friend is out there.
He spits over the scream of the alarm.
So if you want to stop me, mate, come and try.
He shoves again. The door gives with a scream of protest, and a mass of snow and ice comes skittering into the lobby. The doorway is still blocked 4 foot deep, but Danny clambers up the bank and over the top, sinking into the debris. The last I see of him is his legs as he staggers off into the storm.
Oh, my God,
Miranda is saying. She's holding on to Rick like she is drowning.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What if Ava's still out there?
There is no answer. I don't think anyone can bring themselves to say what they are thinking, which is that if Ava is still out there, she is dead. She must be. And maybe Erin, too.
Is the building safe?
Rick says with sudden practicality.
We don't want to stay here if it's about to collapse.
I'll go and turn off that alarm, Tiger says, and she disappears into the kitchen. I hear her dragging a chair across tiles, and then the alarm stops. There is a sudden, shocking silence.
Okay,
Topher says. His voice is shaking, but it is so natural for him to take charge that he slips into the role.
We should check the building.
The kitchen side isn't too bad, Tiger says as she comes back into the lobby. I looked out of the window. There's a couple of windows broken in the den, but the snow isn't particularly high. It'll be the living room side that suffered, and the pool extension.
We should go upstairs,
Topher says.
Get an overview.
Tiger nods. And we all troop upstairs to look out of one of the upper windows. What we see makes my knees go weak. We have been extremely lucky. The long, single-story building to the rear of the chalet, which housed the swimming pool, has been crushed and obliterated. The roof has caved in like an empty eggshell. Beams and planks are sticking out of the huge snowdrift that has engulfed the extension, but the chalet itself is still standing. There is a mass of snow, sticks and rubble piled up against the north side, but the structure has held firm. Just a few metres more and Personnage would have been matchsticks, like the swimming pool building. I can't see any of the other chalets. The path to the funicular is covered with fallen trees and rumpled snow. The funicular itself is out of sight in the gusting snow. Erin is nowhere to be seen. And then I notice a movement around the side of the building. It is Erin. She is holding on to Danny, the chef, and they are limping over the uneven, debris-covered surface, stumbling on the hard-packed lumps of snow scattered across what used to be the track to the funicular. They go out of sight beneath the shadow of the building. From downstairs, I hear the screech of the buckled front door scraping against the tiles and Erin's sob of pain as she squeezes over the drift and down inside the house.
Is it broken?
I hear Danny saying, breathlessly. As if instructed, we all file down the spiral stairs to stand in a concerned circle around Erin.
Is she okay?
Miranda asks, frowning.
What do you think?
Danny snaps. Erin doesn't seem able to speak, but she holds up her hand. I'm not sure what she means, but her signal clearly conveys something to Danny, and he shakes his head angrily and stamps off to the kitchen.
"I'm gonna get you some ice," he calls back over his shoulder. "See if we can get the swelling down."
"I've got some arnica in my bag," Tiger calls after him. I cannot hear Danny's reply. It does not sound complimentary.
"I don't think arnica is going to cut it, Tig,"
Rick says quietly. Erin is slumped on the floor of the lobby. Her face is grey. She looks like she's going into shock. "What happened?" Tiger crouches beside her, putting her hand on her arm. Erin looks up at her. She blinks dazedly. She looks like she is unsure why she is here.
"Erin, are you okay?"
"I don't know,"
Erin manages. Her voice is shaking.
"I was walking towards the funicular and I heard this noise. And then it was like the mountain just came and swallowed the lift."
"You mean the funicular is gone?"
There is horror in Tiger's voice, but her tone only echoes the shock I can see reverberating around the room.
"Not gone," Danny says, coming back with a bag of frozen peas. He scowls around the group. "But, yeah, buried. A big chunk of glass has been stove in."
"Shit! There might have been people in there."
"We should, like, call 999, Annie says, and Topher nods emphatically.
17,
Erin says tiredly.
"What? 17,
Danny echoes.
"That's the French number for the police, but I reckon you should try 112. That's the international number. They'll have English speakers."
Annie takes out her phone and then frowns.
"I've got no reception."
"Transmitter's probably down,"
Danny says shortly. He is pressing the peas very gently onto Erin's ankle. Her face has gone a strange yellowish white and her eyes are closed.
"Try the phone on the desk."
Annie nods and goes across to the landline phone on the desk next to the stairs, but when she picks up the receiver, her face falls.
"There's no dial tone."
"Fuck!"
Carl speaks for the first time. His broad face is red. He looks angry.
"Fucking hell, that's all we need. Avalanche took the line out, I guess. Has anyone got any reception? Anything at all?"
There's a momentary shuffle. Everyone feels for their phones. I get out mine too. The reception bars are greyed out.
"Nothing,"
Topher says. Others are shaking their heads.
"No, wait!"
It's Inigo, his voice cracking with excitement.
"I just got a bar. I've got one bar."
He dials and then waits, holding up his hand for silence. We all stay totally still listening.
"Hello?"
he says, and then,
"Hello? Hello?"
Shit,
it can't hear me.
"Go upstairs," Miranda says sharply. "You might get better reception with the extra height." Obediently, Inigo climbs the spiral staircase and goes to stand at the end of the corridor, at the long window that overlooks the valley, as if the visibility might somehow translate into better reception.
"Hello?"
we can hear him saying, and then,
"Yes."
And,
"Okay."
And,
"Chalet Blanche-Neige."
Followed by some information about our situation. There are long pauses and many times when he says,
"Can you repeat that? I'm sorry, the reception is really poor. You're breaking up. Hello? Hello?"
At last he comes back down looking grave.
"I lost reception in the end, but I spoke to the police operator and I think I managed to give them all the details before I got cut off." "Did you tell them about Ava?"
Topher shoves in and Inigo nods.
Yes, I told them that we lost our friend right before the avalanche, and we don't know if she's still out on the mountain. Is someone coming to rescue us?
I don't know,
Inigo says, and he looks for a minute like what he is, a PA who has failed to get the result his boss wanted.
They said they're under enormous strain. There are people trapped on lifts and stuff. I'm not sure.
His voice falters a little at Topher's expression.
I'm not sure that people with food and shelter are their priority right now. They've got my number. They said they'd be in touch as soon as possible with more information.
You mean we're fucking stranded?
Topher explodes.
The fucking funicular's down. Ava's missing and we're trapped in this godforsaken chalet with an injured woman.
He indicates Erin.
We should be their top priority.
Inigo says nothing. He just shrugs helplessly.
Could one of us ski down?
Rick says, but Inigo shakes his head.
No, they were really clear about that. We should stay where we are. There could be more falls.
Well, we can't just stay here,
Topher says angrily.
You won't be skiing on that piste, mate,
Danny says, looking up from where he's tending Erin.
I'll have you know,
Topher says.
I'm a boarder, and a damn good one.
You could be Sean White, mate. You still wouldn't be going down there. You didn't see it. It looked like a boulder field. There's no piste left.
So, we're stuck?
Topher says, furious disbelief in his tone.
And they're doing nothing at all. While Ava could be out there under 1,000 tons of snow.
No one answers. No one wants to say the fact that is obvious to all of us. If that is the case, there's nothing he or any of us can do.
Erin, Snoop ID Little Mai, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10.
I'm sitting in the kitchen, shaking. Danny has gone to get the first aid kit. And in truth, I'm grateful to be alone for a few minutes. It gives me time to get myself back together. That noise, that horrific, deafeningly soft roar that has haunted my dreams for 3 years. For a moment, I thought it was some kind of flashback, like PTSD. And then I glanced over my shoulder and it was real. A wall of white engulfing the valley. And the strange thing was, I felt nothing but peace as it came towards me. It felt like justice. It felt like retribution. It felt completely right. For a moment, I thought about opening my arms and letting it swallow me. Only it didn't. It didn't swallow me. It spat me back out. To this. I'm gonna fucking kill them all! The swing door bangs back and it's Danny stomping in with the first aid box in his hand.
Fucking wankers, every last one of them. You could have been killed, and he's busy worrying about when his airlift is coming. You know he's out there right now trying to get through to a private helicopter firm.
They won't do anything, even if he gets through, I say. I change my position on the makeshift footrest Danny has set up in the corner of the kitchen, trying to ignore the pain shooting up and down my leg as I move it. They can't. Not in this weather. Look at it. I wave a hand at the window where the wind has picked up into a full-blown blizzard.
Get those peas off your ankle, Danny says brusquely. They've defrosted anyway.
I hold out my leg, meekly, as he lifts off the soggy bag of peas and straps an ice pack sleeve around my throbbing ankle. It hurts, but in a weird kind of way, I welcome the pain. It anchors me, reminding me that I'm here, alive. Danny has found an old FM radio, and while he cooks, I sit quietly listening to the accounts of the rescue attempts. The realization that keeps shivering up and down my spine is how incredibly lucky we have been, all of us. At least 8 buildings have been totally crushed by the avalanche. 4 were lift stations that were confirmed empty since the lifts had been closed earlier that day. 2 were cafes that are believed to have been closed at the time the avalanche hit. The remaining 3 were chalets. 1, much further down near Saint-Antoine-le-Lac, has been evacuated. Minor injuries, no fatalities. No one knows about the other 2. Amid questions about responsibility and whether the resort authorities should have acted earlier, the newscaster emphasises again and again how fortunate it was that so many pistes and lifts were shut. Even the funicular had only 4 people in it, and they have been safely evacuated down the smashed, glassed-in tunnel. But the announcer has already said, ominously, that it is going to take many days to assess the repairs. Not even complete the repairs, assess them. Given that, a mangled swimming pool seems like getting off pretty lightly. If it wasn't for Ava, we would be counting our blessings. But the knowledge that she's still missing is like a dark, spreading poison, gnawing at the edge of everything. When I shut my eyes, I can see her, buried in darkness, growing colder and colder with every moment that passes, wondering if anyone is coming. If she's lucky, the close-packed snow will suffocate her quickly. If she's not, the thought makes me feel suddenly weak with fear. "How much food have we got?" I ask Danny, trying to distract myself from my thoughts, and he shakes his head dismissively.
"Plenty, don't worry about that. Tony Stark down there might have to go without fresh milk for a few days, but the store cupboard's got enough in it for a siege."
There's always the possibility that Ava got bored of waiting for everyone, skied down into Saint-Antoine hours ago, and is absolutely fine, just unable to contact us. But as the hours tick on, that's starting to look more and more unlikely. The landline and the internet are still both down, and the mobile reception has only worsened since the avalanche, the remaining masts presumably buckled beneath 100 weight of snow. But Inigo's phone continues to get a few erratic bars every now and again. He had a text from home, just 1, and managed to reply saying he was okay. Wouldn't Ava have texted to say she was all right when all this kicked off? Wouldn't she have found a way, somehow, to get word through?
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 0.
It is 3:11 p.m. when the electricity dies. I am sitting up in my room trying to shut out the noises from downstairs when the room is suddenly plunged into darkness. I fumble for my phone, wondering if a bulb has blown. Then I hear shouts of annoyance coming from up and down the corridor. It is not just me.
"Did your electricity just go off?"
It is Topher's voice right outside my bedroom. For a moment, I think he's talking to me, but then I hear an answering deep rumble. Elliot.
"Fuck!"
Topher says in answer.
That's all we need.
I open the door to find the rest of the group congregating on the landing, discussing what to do by the light of their mobile phone torches. In the end, we traipse downstairs to consult Erin and Danny. I hang back as Topher knocks irritably on the kitchen door. He is grumbling under his breath about fucking arse end of nowhere.
What?
Danny answers. His expression is belligerent.
Hello,
Topher says, abruptly changing his tone. He is out to charm now. He is not stupid. He knows he has got to get these people on his side. The effect is impressive. It is like a switch being flipped.
So sorry to disturb, but our electricity's gone out. You and me both, mate,
Danny says shortly.
And is there anything one can do?
Topher asks. He's stressed, and I can tell because his accent has become indefinably more moneyed.
Not really. The backup generator was in the pool house.
Danny waves a hand at the debris just visible from the kitchen window. Topher swears. His charm is slipping.
So we just wait and freeze to death?
Not freeze, Danny says.
We've got plenty of wood. You can start by putting a log on the living room fire.
Topher opens his mouth like he is about to say something. Then he seems to think better of it and closes it again. He turns and walks slowly back through to the darkened living room. The rest of us follow. In the lounge, Topher flings himself onto the sofa while Miranda lights candles. Rick opens up the stove, stirs the embers and puts another two logs on top.
Great,
Carl says.
Bloody great. This is all we need. We're going to be fucking ice cubes by the time they find us.
We'll be fine, Miranda says shortly, her voice clipped and annoyed. It's Ava we need to worry about.
Ava? In all the commotion, I had almost succeeded in forgetting about her. My stomach crunches with mingled guilt and anxiety.
There is a long, horrible pause while no one asks the questions that are running in their heads. What has happened to her? Was she caught up in that avalanche? Is she dead?
Wouldn't she have, like, phoned if she were okay?
Annie says at last, breaking the silence. Her usual diffidence is even more pronounced.
I know there's not much signal, but just, like, text, even.
She might not have been able to get through,
Miranda says. But I can tell she is trying to persuade herself, more than convinced by her own argument. Elliot is standing in the corner of the room, looking out at the darkened snow, and then he says something to Topher in his deep, abrupt voice and leaves. Topher gets up from the sofa and follows him without a word. I frown watching them go, watching their shadows leap and flicker in the light from the guttering candles. Where are they going? There is something in Topher's expression I don't like, a sense of sudden purpose, and it gives me a jolt of unease.
Erin, Snoop ID Little My, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10.
This is bad, Erin.
Danny is rummaging through tins at the back of the darkened kitchen. As I watch him, he straightens up, running his hands over his close-cropped hair.
This is very, very bad.
It'll be okay, I say, but the truth is I'm lying, and I know it.
My ankle has puffed up to twice its usual size and still won't bear my weight properly. We have no lighting, and the only heat is from the wood stoves. Danny can't even microwave a frozen curry for dinner. And Ava... But I can't think about that now. I push the image of her white, cold face away from me, locking it behind the door in my mind where I keep images like that, frozen in ice. I have to hold on to the possibility that she's okay, that she made it down into the village and just hasn't been able to get through on the phone. God knows the reception is bad enough.
Your foot could be broken for all we know, Danny says, but I shake my head with a confidence I don't feel.
I don't think it's broken. I think it's just badly sprained.
How the fuck would you know?
Danny asks, and then holds up a hand.
Never mind, I forgot you're a bloody doctor. Tell me again what you're doing, cleaning up after posh wankers for minimum wage.
I could give about 8 different answers to this. I could remind him that I'm not a doctor. I'm a medical school dropout. I could tell him the truth about what brought me to San Antoine. I could give him a lecture on green stick fractures, but I don't need to say any of this because he's gone back to looking through the tins.
I could heat up soup or something on the wood burner, he's saying, his brow furrowed as he tries to read a label with the aid of his mobile phone. Jesus, what a carve-up!
The knock makes us both jump, and we stare at each other, and then Danny goes to the door. It's Topher again, but he's wearing a very different expression to the ingratiating one he used to ask us to magically fix the lights. He looks... I'm not sure. I don't know him well enough to tell. He could be pissed off or gravely worried.
Yes,
Danny says abruptly, but I heave myself to my feet and hobble past him. There is a reason Danny doesn't deal much with front of house. He's got no tact and no patience. But the fact is that however bad the situation is, Topher and Snoop are still our guests, and we still need to behave like we're representing the company. Topher, I say, and then I see Elliot hovering behind him. Elliot, how can I help?
Elliot thinks he's found Ava,
Topher says without preamble.
What?
It's the last thing I'd expected. Questions jumbled through my mind. Where? How?
Is she okay?
We don't know.
Topher pushes past me and Danny and unfolds a laptop, putting it down on the stainless steel kitchen worktop. It lights up the circle of faces with an unearthly glow as he taps in a password. A screen of jumbled code comes up. It means nothing to me.
To be precise,
it's Elliot's deep monotone.
We know the location of her phone.
Her phone?
One of the reasons I didn't want to agree to the buyout,
Topher begins,
is because Elliot's been working on a major update to help monetize Snoop. We're calling it geo-snooping in beta, but that probably won't be the final name. As you probably know, Snoop is as anonymous as you want it to be at the moment. You can't tell where someone is. All you've got to go on is what they declare in their profile.
Right, I say slowly.
But Elliot's been working on an upgrade that will allow people to view other snoopers within a 50-metre radius. You won't know exactly where they are, but you'll know they're close to you.
Okay, I get that.
It hasn't gone live yet, but as part of the preparations for rolling it out, we changed the permissions Snoop requires to give the app access to your location. Basically, Snoop knows that information whether or not you choose to display it. It's part of the data profile we share with stakeholders to create income.
Right, I say again, trying to get him to cut to the chase. I don't care about the inner workings of Snoop, and I think I know where this is going. Are you saying you used this information to find out Ava's location?
Yes. Elliot's been able to hack into the back end and get the GPS coordinates of Ava's phone.
It's here,
Elliot says, pulling up a GPS map, where a red flag shows the location of the coordinates he's tapped into the search bar. As soon as I see the pin, my heart sinks down into my stomach and I feel myself going cold with dread.
Where is it, exactly?
Topher is saying, but his voice sounds very far away now. Danny suddenly puts a hand to his mouth, and I know that he has just figured out what I already knew. The pistes are marked on Elliot's maps, but not the elevations, and without the simplified three-dimensional rendering of the resort's official piste map, it's not very easy to put together the geography of the peaks and valleys. Ava's little dot is showing very close to La Saussière Run, so close, in fact, that she could almost be on the run. But she's not. Because if you've skied the run, as I have many times, what you know is that there is a sheer drop to the side of La Saussière. A drop that falls hundreds, maybe thousands of feet into a deep, inaccessible valley. Somehow, in the blinding snow, Ava must have done exactly what I feared in the first place. She has skied over the edge.
If we can give these coordinates to search and rescue,
Topher is saying with the kind of blithe confidence that only the CEO of a major international company could muster, but I interrupt. I'm sorry, Topher. I'm so sorry.
What do you mean?
This, I swallow. I try to find a way of putting the news that's not too brutal. This dot, it's off the side of the piste.
Ava's an excellent skier,
Topher says confidently.
Off piste, even in this weather?
No, you don't understand. I'm not talking about a bit of loose snow. I mean, she skied off the piste, off the edge. La Saussière. I swallow. There is no way of saying this nicely. That section of La Saussière runs alongside a sheer drop. A very steep one. Topher looks at me blankly, unable or unwilling to understand what I'm trying to tell him.
What do you mean?
He says at last. Topher, if Ava is really where that dot is showing, she's dead. I regret the brutality as soon as the words have left my mouth, but they are said, and they can't be unsaid. Topher's face goes white. Then he turns to Elliot.
How accurate is this positioning?
GPS is typically accurate to about 5 meters,
Elliot says. He looks, God, I don't know, unperturbed, almost. Can that be possible? Surely not. No one could be that callous. Even if they were, wouldn't they at least try to feign some kind of concern?
But you can get interference, bounced signals and so on. I'm not totally sure how the mountains would affect it. It's not impossible, it's a few meters off.
So what, 10 meters? She could be on the piste,
Topher says desperately, but we can all see, looking at the map scale, that that's not possible. Even 50 metres wouldn't put her back on the run.
Or she could have dropped her phone skiing down.
If she dropped it, I think it would be on the run, I say very quietly.
She could have thrown it off the edge, for fuck's sake,
Topher cries. No one responds to this. It's true, of course, but the obvious response is,
Why? And no one can bring themselves to say it, not even Elliot, who simply nods in acceptance of the fact that Topher's remark is essentially correct. All we have found is Ava's phone. It's just very hard to work out how it could have got where it is now without Ava. Fuck, Topher says. He gropes his way to the footrest I was using to prop up my injured foot and sits, as though his legs will no longer hold him up. Fuck!
If she's dead,
Elliot says flatly,
what does that mean for Snoop? Is Ava's husband a shareholder now? Will he get a vote on the buyout?
Fuck! Topher looks wild-eyed, as if he can't believe what's happened.
Arno? I don't know. Jesus, Elliot, how can you...
He breaks off. I can see his brain ticking. Even now, below his grief, he is still Snoop's founder, as much as